The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
What weaknesses do you bring to the table, and how do you plan to overcome them while you're in office?
That's a great question, Joe. Well, I am certainly not perfect, so let's start there. And I think that perhaps a weakness, some would say, but I actually think it's a strength, is I really do value having a team of very smart people around me who bring to my decision-making process different perspectives. My team will tell you, I am constantly saying, let's kick the tire on that. Let's kick the tires on it.
Is there something you can point to in your life, political life or in your life in the last 4 years, that you think is a mistake that you have learned from?
I mean, I've made many mistakes. And they range from, you know, if you've ever parented a child, you know you make lots of mistakes too. In my role as vice president, I mean, I've probably worked very hard at making sure that I am well versed on issues, and I think that is very important. It's a mistake not to be well versed on an issue and feel compelled to answer a question.
You did raise your hand saying in a debate when asked if border crossing should be decriminalized, but obviously that is not your position.
I never intended, nor will I ever allow America to have a border that is not secure. I believe we need to deal with illegal immigration. So I may not be quick to have the answer as soon as you ask it about a specific policy issue sometimes, because I'm going to want to research it. I'm going to want to study it. I'm kind of a nerd sometimes, I confess. And let's not be afraid of having a little joy to the point of, you know, what makes you feel good about your work.
Some voters, though, might ask, you've been in the White House for 4 years, you were vice president, not the president, but why wasn't any of that done for the last 4 years?
Well, there was a lot that was done, but there's more to do, Anderson. And I'm pointing out things that need to be done, that haven't been done, but need to be done. Thank you, Eric. And you're absolutely right. You know it. I know it. I think most Americans know it. Price of groceries is still too high.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
The last 2 minutes that you witnessed there, this was supposed to be the easy one. This is a CNN town hall, friendly media. Those 2 minutes right there, that's what you get when you don't have legitimate Democratic primaries, when you don't get to choose who your candidate is going to be. Right there, that's what you get when Barack Obama picks who your candidate is going to be. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Sam Livingston. I know many of you were hoping for Mr. Stephen Fleury. He emailed me this morning. He's a little bit under the weather. We've had a very busy week. He's been speaking at our church services, and then each day he's not speaking, he's doing the Trumpet Daily, and then if he's not doing that, we were traveling. So he's a bit under the weather, so asked me this morning to fill in. I'm sure he will be back Monday, and we will have lots of coverage going into these chaotic coming 10 days just before the election. If you have any comments for the show, send those to td@thetrumpet.com. Don't forget to check out our Rumble channel, rumble.com/trumpetdaily. So much in those, that was a 2 minute montage. I didn't watch the whole thing. It must have been over an hour. So many things that didn't get fact-checked, so many things that you really couldn't even understand, even if you tried. The point where she is asked about her mistakes is just hilarious. And then she says, if you've ever raised a child, you know you've made mistakes. Kamala has not raised a child that I'm aware of. There might be something that she's not telling people. I assume she's referring to Doug Emhoff's two kids. One of them was at least 20 when they got married. The other one was probably in their late teens. So I don't know that Kamala's done any raising of children. Of course, her saying she needs to research questions, She's a bit of a nerd. Did you know that? You wouldn't have known that. Nobody would think that about Kamala Harris. My favorite, of course, was when she's asked by Anderson, well, why didn't you do that when you were in office? You've been in office for 4 years. I mean, this is my favorite response all time to, well, why didn't you finish that? Or why didn't you get that done? There was a lot that was done, but there's more to do. I'm pointing out things that need to be done, that haven't been done, but need to be done. Right, so why didn't you do them? Well, because they need to be done. Whatever. This is a Washington Post article. This came out. This was right after they stole the election. They probably published this because they were trying to bury it in all of the election drama. This was December 4th, 2021. It's titled, A Kamala Harris Staff Exodus Reignites Questions About Her Leadership Style and Her Future Ambitions. It says staffers who worked for Harris before she was vice president said one consistent problem was that Harris would refuse to wade into briefing materials prepared by staff members, then berate employees when she appeared unprepared. She's a bit of a nerd. She likes to really research and dig into things. The Post says, this is quoting one of her former staffers, it's clear that you're not working with somebody who is willing to do the prep and the work, one former staffer said. With Kamala, you have to put up with a constant amount of soul-destroying criticism and also her own lack of confidence, so you're constantly sort of propping up a bully, and it's not really clear why. It's not really clear why we're propping up this bully. And then you think about all the stuff that they come out with about Donald Trump, about the lies. I mean, Cassidy Hutchison, and there's John Kelly now, Mark Milley. They just make up these stories about how awful he is. And then they're totally rebutted by people who were there in the room. These stories about how mean Kamala is, how lazy she is. I mean, Trump said it. She's lazy. She'd rather talk, just like Obama, would rather talk about the TV shows, would rather talk about the Netflix series. You hear all the regime media say, you've got to pick the candidate that wakes up in the morning and is thinking about you. And that's not Donald Trump. That's what they say. As if Kamala and Barack Obama and Joe Biden, who, I won't go there, as if they wake up in the morning and they're just, what can I do for America today? What is going on in this country? I mean, you look at 3 months ago where we were. It was the swoon fest for Kamala. And then 3 months later, they're talking about Donald Trump winning the popular vote. We were in New York for a while, and granted, it was rural New York. There are Trump signs everywhere. You see the Kamala Harris signs when you get into a really wealthy area, of course, and all the mansions, they'll have the Harris Walls sign up there. Inflation doesn't hit them too hard. But they're talking about New York. Now, we'll play the clip a little bit later. Now, they're not saying, oh, well, the polls show Trump's winning it, though there might be a chance. Trump thinks there is. But they're talking about him winning the electoral vote because in California and New York, where there are more Republican voters than in any other state, he's getting more of the independents to come over, and he could possibly win the popular vote. Now, again, you can't get your hopes up because there's the Electoral College, and he's not going to win California either. Expect the craziest election ever. But also at the same time, it could be totally normal. It could be Donald Trump winning in a landslide. I mean, it's pointless to speculate on every tiny thing that could happen. But what we do know is at some point, Donald Trump will be back in the Oval Office. And in reality, he never left. Just because they certified it, just because some men decided that, doesn't make it so. Just because they lied about it and told the big lie, doesn't make it so. Dems, they're known for creating quite a bit of panic going into elections. Maybe they're doing that to try to stir up their own base to say, hey, we don't have this in the bag. You've got to get out there and vote. I mean, you could get into the politics all you want there. But and what's true at the end of the day is Kamala Harris is Obama's pick, is a bad pick. She was a bad pick in 2019 when she got no votes in the primaries. So that should be a pretty good indicator she's not popular. It was a bad pick for her to be the vice president. Again, a pick you make when you're planning to steal an election, when you're not trying to win anybody over. She was from California. You're not winning over any voters with her. And then to run out and make her the pick for 2024, nobody voted for her. You're seeing it. And this is, in a lot of ways, this is Obama losing power, you could say. I mean, he liked her. He wanted her. Joe Biden didn't want her in there. He wanted someone else. I think it was Klobuchar. He kept talking about wanting her and how he got along better with her. And Obama, he's not as smart as he once was. He's not as sophisticated with his lies as he used to be. People are seeing through it. Notice this reaction. This is the reaction to Kamala's town hall on CNN. This is, some of these are Republicans on CNN, but again, there's one from Dana Bash saying it like it is, the response to that town hall. This is clip two.
Listen, Kamala Harris participated in a one-person debate last night, and she lost. Okay, she was asked direct questions, and she provided very circular answers.
The things that would concern me is when she doesn't want to answer a question, her habit is to kind of go to word salad city. And she did that on a couple of answers.
I think they are leaning into everything that has nothing to do with the core problem of the campaign, which is that people just don't really know what she would do as the president.
Well, I'll just tell you what I'm hearing from people who I have been talking to. And that is that if her goal was to close the deal, they're not sure she did that. And, you know, some people have asked, is she being held to a different standard? Maybe. But that's maybe the world that she's living in. And on the question of who she is, people are understanding that a little bit more. But what she will do, the question about her legislative priorities, name one, there wasn't one. You know, some more of her personality and her sort of character questions about your weaknesses or what mistakes did you make? Not necessarily the answers there.
She was supposed to seal the deal. This was a gimme. They're all gimmies. She did one difficult thing. I don't even know if you could say that that was difficult, but going on with Bret Baier, that was the one challenge she faced. Here she is, like that one man said, she's by herself. No one's challenging her. No one's really pushing back on her. It's Anderson Cooper. And she can't even articulate. She can't even say one mistake she made. Granted, that could be hard if you're put right on the spot. But I suspect they gave all of those answers ahead or those questions ahead of time. And not only was she not, she was asked that question twice. My biggest mistake, some people call it a flaw, I really call it a strength, is that I surround my people with smart people who give me good advice. In what world is that a weakness? What, she said it twice. I forgot her answer to the second one that Anderson Cooper... Oh, I've worked very hard at making sure I'm well-versed on issues. When Anderson Cooper asked, well, what are some things you regret or what's a mistake? And she said... I can't even articulate it. I'm trying to read it and comment on it, and I don't even know what point she was trying to make. So here we are. We've got Kamala Harris, and what is she running on? It's supposed to be a new way forward. She can't even answer what that new way is. Well, it's not Donald Trump. We're back to, like Mr. Fleury said, their closing argument is not joy, it's Trump is Hitler. Where we've been the last 10 years. This is Axios. Behind the curtain, Dems fear they're blowing it. A growing number of top Democrats tell us privately they feel Vice President Harris will lose, even though polls show a coin toss finish 11 days from now. Obama and Biden were talking about her not being a strong candidate. This is after Democrats spent $1 billion, nearly twice as much as Republicans over the past 3 months to polish her image and soil former President Trump's. Trump and allied committees raised about half Harris's total, $92 million from October 1st to the 16th. They write, Harris's rhetorical journey has mirrored Democratic moods from joy over the summer to darkness this week when she painted Trump as a dangerous fascist. And I doubt they're that word. They know that they can steal. Remember, never forget what they did in 2020. None of that was reconciled. So why wouldn't they do that again? I don't know. Maybe a part of it is that they try to do it again and they actually don't have the power to pull it off because Obama is losing power. There's the clip. I won't bother playing it, but it's the Kamala rally and they pull out Bruce Springsteen. I'm not familiar with all of his stuff, but even the way he's talking, there's just nothing that gets you that excited about it. And then he concludes with, I'm here to support Kamala. No, he starts just like Joe Biden, says, my name's Bruce Springsteen, just like Joe Biden. My name's Joe Biden. And then he concludes his little opening remark with, Kamala's running to be president. Donald Trump's running to be an American tyrant. Just joy. So exciting. Really moving people. And what a lot of commentators are saying now is that they're making the mistake they made in 2016. And that is, you've got an unlikable candidate, and now they're resorting to insulting the voters. Who would vote? What basket of deplorables would vote for Donald Trump? And this isn't some tech. This is just their heart. This is what they go to. It was inevitable. There was never a joy campaign. It's anti-Trump, and they've said it before. Well, Kamala, she's not Donald Trump. There's a lot of things that aren't Donald Trump. But people have 4 years to compare. They have 4 years of President Trump, and they've got 4 years of Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, Barack Obama. We've got the 8 years of Obama himself. And it's just pretty simple to a lot of people. And you look at, again, we've talked about the October surprises. Really, John Kelly, not Trump admires Hitler. I haven't heard that one before. Now the latest one, Drudge is blasting it over that Donald Trump groped a woman. She has to wait. What was it? I think I didn't put the 1993, she said that this happened. So 724, 31 years later, after all these other women come forward, she's holding out. 12 days before the election, she brings that one out. Nobody believes it. Nobody buys it. We've all been here before. But she used to work for I think she actually still works for this group called Clean Tech for Obama. And they were this big fundraiser for Barack Obama in 2008, raised over $2 million for him and got all of the policy decisions that they wanted out of it as well. So I haven't looked into the details that much of, you know, why she's coming out now. But again, it gets the bright red letters on Drudge and then it's gone. The momentum shift is incredible to witness. I mean, Drudge, talk about losing power. Drudge doesn't have the power it did. That's really the only place you see some of these stories. And then Morning Joe has to spend 3.5 hours talking about them in the morning. Notice this little bit of joy. This was at Kamala's campaign yesterday. And notice how irritated Barack Obama is getting. This is clip 4.
Kamala wasn't born into privilege. She was raised in a middle-class family. She worked at McDonald's when she was in college to pay her expenses. She didn't pretend to work at McDonald's when it was closed for a photo op.
Back to middle class Kamala. And notice how much that stunt. It was a stunt. They did close down the McDonald's. They, of course, screened the people coming through the drive-thru. Can you imagine just letting anybody roll up to the drive-thru and be 3 feet away from the President of the United States after there have been 4 attempts made on his life? At least 3. Of course that was going to be staged, but he made a good point. And he got a lot of people talking, and he broke the internet for that day, and Kamala still won't say whether or not it's true she worked at McDonald's. So you've got Donald Trump bringing the joy. That was a funny day. And then here's Barack Obama. I mean, the freeze frame, he even looks angry there, getting mad about it, but won't talk about Kamala going to Pittsburgh and kicking everyone out of the restaurant and bringing in all of her surrogates, all of her fanboys, to cheer her on and make it look like it's this authentic thing. What wasn't fake, though, at Trump visiting that McDonald's was him driving down that street with thousands of people on the sidewalk. This clip, I couldn't believe this clip. This was Nicole Wallace. And I thought maybe at least she said this before Kamala's CNN town hall. Even if she did that, it still would be a ludicrous statement. But she said this following Kamala Harris's CNN town hall, following the montage that we played at the top of this show. Notice her reaction. This is clip five.
And I worked on campaigns, so I can sort of analyze a campaign, and it's been perfect. It's been flawless. The ads are quick. The response is rapid. The vice president is a stunningly disciplined and empathetic candidate. I mean, what she did at the CNN town hall was to field questions as the only person running for president who had enough respect for the voters of this country to show up. The person she's running it against wasn't even there. I mean, that was his giant FU to voters. Yeah. Trump didn't show. She shows up. She fields all the questions from the undecided voters and from Anderson Cooper. What is your sense of sort of the disconnect between what is actually happening on the campaign and the angst that a lot of people feel?
I don't know what world she's living in. That Donald Trump did town halls that Kamala wasn't at. They do them by themselves. It wasn't a debate. So for her to say, well, Trump wasn't there, he's a no-show, you could go back to the Al Smith dinner. You could go to the Fox debate that Kamala didn't want to do. For her to say, following the spread of word salads, the buffet, for her to witness that and to come out and say, this campaign has just been run perfectly. It's flawless. Why is there a disconnect? Why don't people see that? It's your fault. You're the reason that Kamala, I don't even know how to articulate that point. It's your fault for not seeing that she's perfect. Nicole Wallace sees it because she's totally has a sane mind. She sees it. Well, what's the disconnect? Because she believes she's living in reality. Her little bubble there is the real world, and she can't comprehend why the rest of the world doesn't think the way she does. I had a clip, it's longer, but it's from the historian John Meacham, and he's talking about how it's not Harris that's on trial here, it's not Trump that's on trial, it's the American people that are on trial. And if they pick President Trump, well, then we've lost our ability to, what did he say in there? Provide a rational account of a candidate. It's the democracy's fault. Apparently, they hate democracy. If the majority of people pick the candidate they hate, well, it's their inability to be rational. And they're doing exactly what Hillary did with the deplorables comment. And it's not winning anyone over. If they're talking about President Trump potentially winning the popular vote because he's getting so many more voters in New York and California, then that almost makes those swing states stop being swing states. If he's getting that much momentum in dark blue states, well then Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, it's game over, right? Again, it could go any way. I mean, you've got to expect the worst with the way they operate. Notice Hillary Clinton, she had an interview. She comes out again, and they keep making this weird comparison. I shouldn't say it's weird anymore because they've been doing it the last 10 years, but Trump's holding this rally at Madison Square Garden, and apparently anybody that does anything at Madison Square Garden, I guess including the New York Knicks, right? This is a callback to America's Nazi past. Notice clip six.
And, you know, one other thing that you'll see next week, Caitlin, is Trump actually reenacting the Madison Square Garden rally in 1939. I write about this in my book. President Franklin Roosevelt was appalled that neo-Nazis, fascists in America were lining up to essentially pledge their support for the kind of government that they were seeing in Germany. So I don't think we can ignore it.
I think even some of the regime media pundits are getting a little bored with this talking point. I mean, Madison Square Garden is iconic. Why wouldn't you want to do a rally there? And it's downtown Manhattan. That's an awesome place to go have a rally, right in dark blue Manhattan. And to see that get filled up, that's hilarious. And James, I think it's, I can't remember his first name, Carville, the guy always wearing the LSU Tigers sweatshirt when he's at a round table and everyone else is wearing a suit. He keeps bringing up this Madison Square Garden. Trump's bringing out this Madison Square Garden. Adolf Hitler did it. And you almost see the host there, like, kind of roll their eyes. Okay, what? It's just lots of people do things at Madison Square Garden. And this is their closing argument. Can't define any policy. Can't even say just the tiniest mistake Kamala Harris made. And it's Trump is Hitler. I thought yesterday the New York Post, they came out. They announced their endorsement for President Trump. Choice is clear to put nation on right path back to the future. Again, like I said earlier, the momentum shift. 2 years ago, when President Trump announced he was running, the New York Post hated him. All of them did. It was the, see the little blue banner there that's talking about the Yankees? When Donald Trump announced he was running, that little blue banner just said, Florida man announces campaign. They didn't want him. They all were in on DeSantis. And I didn't even think it was exactly 2 years ago. But look where we are now. Back to the future. I mean, who could foresee that? Who could see that coming 2 years ago, 4 years ago? Kimberly Strassel at the Wall Street Journal. Kamala's basket of deplorables. If she loses, it will be because she decided to reprise Hillary Clinton's campaign. Her opening remarks at the event consisted of two sentences, noting she'd been a prosecutor and lived outside Washington before pivoting to what was at stake and talking about President Trump. Strassel writes, Americans have heard all of this before thousands of times. Mrs. Clinton battered Mr. Trump in 2016 is more toxic than botulism, utterly unfit for the Oval Office. Talks about the deplorables comment. And then talks about how she couldn't answer any questions at that town hall. Strassel writes, all the space in between these nothing burgers was, of course, filled with casting Mr. Trump as the root of all evil. Her bigger problem, this portrayal of Mr. Trump as an unconscionable pick, is potentially turning voters away as it did in 2016. Notice this clip. This is CNN. Enten, he's the big pollster guy. Notice him talking about Trump potentially winning the popular vote. Clip 8.
Trump may finally get his great white whale. Harris versus Trump national march. And you mentioned that New York Times poll, a tie. That's actually right in the middle of the spectrum when we're talking about recent polling data. You don't have to look very far to find Donald Trump ahead nationally. He was up by 2 points in the CNBC poll, up by 3 in the Wall Street Journal poll. Very close races within the margin of error. But then the same thing on the other side, right? You have Harris up by 3 points according to Ipsos. The Say 24 YouGov poll, that's a bunch of academics, also has Harris up by 3. But the bottom line is, with the popular vote, which we really haven't focused upon, a very, very tight race, John. Fact is, Donald Trump is very much in a position he could win the popular vote, which, of course, is something he would absolutely love to do.
And would be something very different than we have seen compared to last time and the polling compared to last time.
Exactly right. So I went back through the time machine, all right? I went back through the time machine to see where were the past two races at this point in the campaign. Look, Harris in the average poll right now is up by 1, well within the margin of error. You go back 4 years ago, Joe Biden was well ahead of Donald Trump in the national popular vote polls. He was up by 9. Even Hillary Clinton was up by 6 points. So now Donald Trump's in a position he really hasn't been before at this point in the campaign where he could truly compete. And we can truly say that the popular vote at this point is way too close to call. Of course, this is only going back 8 years. I wanted to jump even further back in my time machine to get an understanding. Hey, I haven't heard about a Republican potentially winning the popular vote in a while. And it turns out a Republican winning the popular vote, it hasn't happened since 2004 in George W. Bush defeating John Kerry. And that's only the one time that it has happened. In fact, you have to go all the way back to 1988 to find another one when it was George W. Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, winning the popular vote over Michael Dukakis. So the fact that the polls right now are so close, John, the fact that Donald Trump has a legitimate shot of winning the popular vote is something I think a lot of folks, including in my line of work, really didn't think could possibly happen when Donald Trump was running last time around. He could make history, not just for Donald Trump, for a Republican candidate as well.
Now,
that's incredible. He lost, quote unquote, the popular vote by, I think it was 6 or 7 million votes. And they're talking about that flipping the other way. Washington Examiner, Trump's tipping point. The former president may be on the cusp of returning to office. With just days to go until the 2024 presidential election, former President Donald Trump is well positioned to reclaim the office he lost 4 years ago. Granted, the future is always difficult to predict, especially in American politics, but all the evidence available right now favors Trump. Who was talking about him coming back 4 years ago? I mean, we have this article. This is a recent one, Why God is Protecting This Man. Go back and look at those articles from 4 years ago. Why Donald Trump will remain America's president, why I still believe Donald Trump is coming back, all in early 2021, because we're not interested in what pollsters say. We're not interested in what the political analysts say. God operates at a higher level than we can comprehend. He's not governed by some dates that are set by men. We need the Bible. We need Bible prophecy. It gives you the big trend line. It gives you the big overview. Many do believe the Bible, but they scoff at the thought of using Bible prophecy as a tool to understand the news. You've got to have that as the backbone to make sense of all of this, to understand where we're going and what it means, to give you vision to see through all of this joy that we see on the news every day. I wanted to conclude today's program playing A Key of David that aired recently. It's titled Christ Coming is at the Very Door. And Christ, he is a prophet. He gave signs that we are to watch for that show when his return will be. And that's ultimately what all of these events are about. That's why we watch them. That's why we comment on them, because of what it's leading to. It wouldn't mean anything if it wasn't leading to this great hope of Jesus Christ's return. So this program, this aired originally a few years ago. Mr. Fleury had it play on TV a couple weeks ago. Again, it's titled Christ's Coming is at the Very Door. We can just transition right into that. Thank you very much for joining us on today's Trumpet Daily. Hope you have a wonderful weekend, and we will see you Monday.
Jesus Christ was the greatest prophet of all time. While on earth, he revealed six signs of his second coming. To be protected in the dangerous days ahead, you need to be able to discern these signs. Learn what these signs are next on The Key of David with Gerald Fleury.
Greetings, everyone. Matthew chapter 24 gives us six signs of when all these things will come to pass. It says in Matthew 24 that he will give us signs where we, six of them, and specifically I want to talk to you about today, that will show you that his second coming is at the very door. Of course, a lot of other events are at the very door too. You can see they're all intertwined, and we want to tie them together, and it really reveals a great deal. So I want to discuss those six signs today and show you that Christ's coming is at the very door. Now, that is the way it's expressed in Matthew 24, and one of those signs is even that God will protect you now and in the future if you will obey Him and if you will help declare His warning message. Now, you can look at all the history of the New Testament, and you'll see that God never said to any of the apostles of the first century, or later until this very end, that the second coming of Christ is at the very door. The only time he says it in the Bible is in the last era to the last apostle. Then he says it is at the very door, and then he shows us how to prove that to ourselves from Matthew 24. Let me read that to you, this verse about the being at the very door. There are actually two verses, Matthew 24, verses 32 and 33. Now learn a parable of the fig tree. when his branch is yet tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So likewise, when you shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the door, the Moffat translation says. Even at the door. And Christ's return is, you can know when it's right at the door. You won't know the day or the hour, but you will know when it's at the door. That's critical to understand. We have some reprint articles I want to send you at the end of this program, but here is one of them on how not to be deceived. And that was an article in The Trumpet, and it talks a lot about this subject. But notice what it says in Matthew 24 and verse 3. And as Jesus sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of your coming, number one, and the end of the age, it should read. So I want to read something that I wrote in one of these articles. It says that Matthew 24 and verse 3 refers to the two commissions of the end time. The sign of your coming refers to the commission of preaching God's gospel around the world. And the sign of the end of the age refers to God's commission to prophesy again in the Laodicean era, or the last era of God's church. You can read about that in my book, Malachi's Message, and we will send it to you. All of our literature is free. But we want you to understand this. You do have to do some studying, and we'll do everything we can to help you understand it, because it's really the most important prophetic message that Jesus Christ ever delivered. The most important single one, I should say. So pay close attention to that, and you will understand things that will stun you, I do believe. This article goes on to say, what was the sign of Christ's coming? Well, the gospel was preached around the world. I'll show you that. What is the sign of the end of the age? Well, the work of God's church today, the commissions of those two eras are both signs, but only one of them belongs to this six I'm talking about today. God gave two signs. The great gospel commission was the sign to this world of Christ's imminent return. The return is near when you see that sign. But it doesn't say it's at the very door. It just says where his return is imminent and it is near. But then there's another part of that. There's a dual prophecy here, and we want to look at both sides of it. But notice verse 14 and see what it says there. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. It's going to be a witness to all nations, and then shall the end come. But here's the thing that you have to understand, and this is a little bit more, requires a little more study if we're going to understand it and have the real clarity there. Then the end shall come, and the word end in verse 14 is not the same Greek word as the end in verse 3. The commentaries tell us that the context must reveal which end is being discussed in verse 14. When he's talking about the gospel being preached to the world, well, that's a different end than the one here in verse 14. The context has to tell us what the one in 14 means, and it, of course, it's really about understanding all these things in Matthew 24. That's what this end is about here in verse 14. I continue with the article. The context shows us that this is the end of the period during which the gospel was preached to the world as the primary commission. So this Matthew 24 and verse 14 end is not the end of this age discussed in verse 3. The disciples asked two questions. Well, what shall be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Again, we have here a twofold sign. The first sign of Christ's coming is the preaching of the gospel around the world. The second question specifically is about the sign of the end of the age of man. See, when all these things come to pass, that's the sign of the end of the age of man. And of course, Christ returns then. Christ says that when these things are at the very door, it's at this end of all these events that are unfolding in Matthew 24. Now, we'll give you a lot of material to help you understand this, but it is something that we have to study. But it is one of the most exciting studies you'll ever have in the Bible, because it's the greatest prophetic message, single message, that Christ delivered. What is so great about it? Well, that's what we need to understand. Notice Matthew 24:14 again. God begins to specifically emphasize the end of the age sign in the Laodicean era, or the last era of the church, not the one when the gospel was preached around the world. That's the sixth era, but all these things are coming to pass in the seventh era. If you talk about specific fulfillments. And that's what we're talking about here. But God says that last era has to prophesy again, and that will take us right up to, it tells us all about at the very door when Jesus Christ himself is going to return to this earth. That's what it's all about. God inspired the disciples to ask their questions the way they did. It is clearly about the last two eras of God's true church. And I wanted to read that to you to try to make it as clear as possible. We need to understand this magnificent prophecy. So the first sign I'm giving you is not when Christ's coming is at the very door, but it is near. That's the difference. It is near. Really, when that gospel is preached around the world, that's when all of these events begin to unfold and be fulfilled specifically in Matthew 24. That's the last era of God's church. So Christ gives us the six signs when the second coming of Christ is at the very door. He gives us the six signs. And it's at the end of this age, in the beginning of Christ's rule. It's a dual sign. And it comes to us in the very last era, which leads directly into the second coming of Jesus Christ. So let me give you these six signs from Matthew 24, which are at the very door, shows that we are at the very time when Jesus Christ is about to return. It's at the very door. So that we have to keep in mind. Now, let me just read something to you from verses 4 and 5 of Matthew 24. Now notice the first and most important warning Christ gave his disciples. Quote, "And Jesus answered and said unto them, Take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I'm Christ, and shall deceive many." So they'll come and they'll be talking about Christ, and that will deceive many people, because they don't tell you what his message is. They talk about his person, not the message that he delivered. And that gets them into deep trouble, including God's own church, his own people. That's how deceptive Satan the devil is. Notice verse 11 of Matthew 24. Verse 11 talks about some special people of God's. "And many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. And because iniquity," or lawlessness, it should read, "shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. And he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved." But the word love here is translated from the Greek word agape, which is the very love of God. So this means it has to be God's people. And they have the very love of God. God had to beget them and give them his Holy Spirit and the very love of God. And they're waxing cold and losing that love. That's the problem. And it says in the Greek that the majority of them were deceived. That is 95% of God's own people. A shocking event in the history of God's church. One of the greatest falling away, if not the biggest ever, I think it is really, the biggest falling away ever And how does that happen? Because they don't understand Matthew 24. They let their love wax cold. They don't love God. They don't love His message and hunger and thirst after righteousness the way they did in the beginning. And what a terrible mistake that is. They've gotten into lawlessness. Now, this is the synagogue of Satan that started before verse 14 was completed. That is, before this gospel was fully preached around the world by a man in that sixth era. Well, then there was a synagogue within the church that was fighting against him and fighting against what he was teaching, and they had that rebellion, and after this man died, God's leader died, those men took over the church of God, and it became the Laodicean or the lukewarm era. The lukewarm era that God says He's just going to spew them out of His mouth, because they turned away from the teachings of the man who established and restored all things. So says your Bible, Matthew 17, verses 10 and 11. So the number one sign is 95% of God's own people rebel. And you can see where the Laodicean story is in Revelation 3, verses 14 and 22, where it talks about them becoming lukewarm and rebellious toward God. Verse 12, of course, it talks about iniquity or lawlessness. Moral and spiritual decay is just going to abound. It's just all over the place in this world, and God's people get swept up in it. Now, that is a real problem. It says most of you, or the majority, get taken in by that, and there is such a moral decay that Mr. Armstrong said at one time that it's more dangerous than the nuclear bomb, because of degeneration and getting mixed up in lawlessness and every kind of sin you can imagine. Then verse 21, here is sign number two, which helps us see that we're at the very door of the second coming. Verse 21, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. For the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. So the second sign is the nuclear weapons are poised to destroy all humanity. That's what Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22 talks about. Here we're talking to North Korea, and they've had a real breakthrough in their nuclear development, and they're really sort of playing games with us, it seems, but they are dangerous. But this is little North Korea that is threatening America because they have missiles with nuclear warheads that are capable of reaching American cities. Little North Korea. Now, what do you think about that? See, this is a bizarre, extreme leader. He actually shows an eagerness to want war with the U.S., a nuclear war. Now, that's a kind of madness that it's hard to imagine, but that's the way some people in this world are thinking. Moffat translates it as the crisis at the close, where it talks about the time of the end. It means the crisis of all crises. And God is trying to get our attention. Kim Jong-un is that's just little North Korea. What about all the bombs that China has, that Russia has, and France has a lot of bombs, and Britain has a lot of bombs, and Israel has a lot of bombs, and Brazil has a lot of bombs, and Pakistan has a lot of bombs. I might just mention also that Europe has a lot of our atomic bombs that we've let them have. But isn't it folly to think that anybody could solve these problems except God Himself? Who could possibly solve all these problems except God? So we need to keep that in mind. Let's look at sign number three, verse 37, but as in the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Verse 37, verse 38, for as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Noah preached this message about the flood coming for 100 years, and they taunted and jeered him and continued to rebel. Well, God says it's going to be the same way today as in the days of Noah. You give them all the facts, all the information, all the proof they could possibly need, and they scorn it. And they're going to pay a heavy price for that. God is showing His love, expressing it, trying to save them from themselves and their own nuclear bombs. But if they won't listen, they're going to have to experience all of that, so we'd better learn some lessons. And even if it's individually, God says, look, if a nation doesn't do it, or your nation doesn't do it, and you do it, I'll protect you. I'll show you that. So they were really evil in the days of Noah, and it says their every thought was on evil continually. Can you imagine a man being that evil? Every single thought is evil. That is just a marvelous example to show us how inept and incapable the human mind is of doing anything righteous, it seems. Certainly not, they're not going to save themselves. Notice now, sign number 4, verse 40, then shall two leaders be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left. Well, what's happening here? Two women, they have a leader, and here's the two women, or two churches, that's a symbol of church, shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken and the other left. Well, they're both grinding, they're both doing the work, but one of them is lukewarm and they're rich and increased with goods. They're putting that ahead of God and His family and His kingdom. And God says He's going to protect one church and He's not going to protect the other, which is 95% of God's own people. If that doesn't sober us and make us realize that this is certainly dangerous knowledge in some way, but it's the most wonderful news you could possibly hear. And God says, okay, I'll take you out of that. I'll save you from it. And He'll protect you not only, let's say, at the end or right before the Great Tribulation, but He'll protect you up until that time. That is a wonderful, wonderful blessing from God. So the fourth sign is only one of God's churches is protected. And why are they protected? Because they're found doing, in verse 46, found doing the work of God. Another reprint article was written by myself, and it's titled, Was Jesus a Prophet? And you please ask for that, because it has quite a lot of information on what I'm talking about today. But then in verse 41, you can see that one church was grinding. They were doing the work, but it was lukewarm. God wasn't impressed. And He says, now watch and be careful. Watch and pray so you don't get caught up in all of this. God is pleading with us almost and trying to get us to understand. Luke 21, verse 36 says, from hour to hour keep awake, from the Moffat translation. You better keep awake. Don't go to sleep in this terrible, terrible time. And of course, that God is preparing us today for that second coming so we can share His rule over the entire earth. Then verse 45, who then is faithful and wise servant whom his Lord has made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he comes, shall find so doing. God is going to bless those people when he comes back, if he finds that they are so doing the work of God. That's the people, that's the group that God is going to save, physically and spiritually. Verily I say unto you that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. Well, how about that? He's going to make them ruler over the entire universe. And that little 5% that does the work, he's going to have them sit there with him at headquarters for all time. It says in Revelation 3 and verse 12, that they shall go no more out. They're headquarters people because they've learned so much and they've obeyed God and He's really blessing them mightily. Well, you can go on and see verse 48. The rebels lose their vision here. But, and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, my Lord delays his coming. Now, and he's getting in a bad attitude. And he just, well, if he delays his coming, I can't wait. I don't have the faith to do that. I don't have the patience. And they just go along with all that evil. Verse 49, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunken. The Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looks not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder and appoint him his abortion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now that's a horrible time that is coming upon this earth. So what does the sixth sign do? Well, God is going to punish His people. And the 50% of that 95% are going to repent in the Great Tribulation, the nuclear tribulation. But 50% of them are never going to repent. Of people who had the very Spirit of God and had the very power of God and all the understanding of God, but they just couldn't wait. If he didn't come when they thought He should, so they just turned away from God. This is dangerous knowledge, but it's the most wonderful knowledge you could ever hear. Christ is planning us this and helping all of us to be His own bride, His own wife. Revelation 19 and verse 7. So we think like our husband. We sit on the throne and share His throne with Him for all eternity. What could be greater than that? Until next week, this is Gerald Fleury. Goodbye, friends.